This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk with veteran reporter Matt Skinner in Oklahoma about the tragedy this week that took the lives of 24 people, tornadoes hitting the Sooner State once again. Capitol watcher C.B. Fragonston is in the house to talk about what happened in Baton Rouge down the street at the state capitol this week. Much going on, and also there is evidence that David Vitter and Jay Darden are putting the gears in motion for a mano matchup in the 2015 gubernatorial race. And James Lacy, he's with the U.S. Marine War College. His book is Moment of Battle, The 20 Clashes That Changed the World. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Eekster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside our area. 877-217-5757. We begin with Matt Skinner. He was news director at the Oklahoma Radio Network for a decade and now works in state government in the Sooner State. And as you know, and as we've talked about, it's been quite a week of tragedy in the state that is the adopted one for Matt Skinner. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Well, you were there a few days ago when the tornado roared through, killed 24 people, destroyed thousands of homes. What's it like on the ground in Oklahoma right now?
Well, it's a time of restoration. We're into we've gone from the first response to now the recovery mode, and it's cleanup time. The mutual aid has poured in for all the utilities, of course. Since Monday, they're actually now packing up and going home. Those areas that can receive power are pretty much back online. There's still some work to do in terms of transmission lines and whatnot. But overall, it's a slow, steady progress toward cleaning up and moving on from there.
Well, early estimates indicate the tornado caused more than $2 billion worth of damage and more, and whole subdivisions in the community were destroyed. It's not a large area either, 56,000 people. You can only imagine the kind of damage that would be involved if this went through a heavily congested urban area. But nonetheless, $2 billion is a mighty amount. The devastation must be almost unspeakable, Matt.
It more has been hit before, as most people probably have heard, because the news reports keep bringing it up. On May 3rd, 1999, more got hit by a monster tornado at that time. I think it was the strongest recorded tornado. Now that's been dwarfed by this one. The tornado took approximately the same path. I would say this is not an isolated area. It is an urban area. The Oklahoma City metro area is one of the largest in the nation, and it spreads out and encompasses various suburbs. So Moore could certainly be considered an urban area.
But I suspect not millions of people live in this area. We're talking much less a numerous populace, but nonetheless, it is part of the Oklahoma City metropolitan area. You probably were not too far from the storm when it hit.
No, I wasn't. We had to take shelter at the Capitol twice and go down into the basement as the warnings went off. The estimate, it should be stressed, for the $2 billion is not just more. It includes the entire Oklahoma City metro area. So when you look at more and say 56,000 people, you're actually talking an area that has almost 2 million people in it. And South Oklahoma City was hit extremely hard, as was Norman, where OU is, and other areas as well. But Moore certainly took the brunt of it.
Well, the stories that originally were reported, including one from Tim Talley of the Associated Press, who used to work right here at the Baton Rouge Advocate, indicated that 51 people were killed. It seems stories in the last few days have the number at 24. How did we have 51 at one point?
I do not know. Well, the way you got it was from the medical examiner's office. Now, what happened at that office to go from 51 down to 24 is subject of investigation.
Matt, you have been on this show in the past and have discussed the Oklahoma City bombing incident in 1995. That one, as far as a national story with relevance, continues to this day. Tornadoes, of course, and unfortunately, they come and go. But how does this compare as far as the mood in the city and in the metropolitan area right now?
You know, I always hate to do comparisons because different, obviously, different events have a different kind of investment in terms of your emotions, in terms of what your job is and that kind of thing. I would say certainly that, you know, tragedy and horror certainly go hand in hand in both incidents. I just don't like to get into comparisons.
Well, you must remember the day, April 19th, 1995, now 19 years, almost 19 years later, 18 years and change, with the same kind of vivid recollection that occurred on the day it happened. Will the same be for what happened this past week in the aftermath of the catastrophe in Moore, Oklahoma?
Oh, I think absolutely. And I say that both as a former storm victim myself who lost everything in a storm and in dealing as a reporter and as a state official with numerous tornadoes and storm, when you have something like this, it's etched forever in your mind.
Hmm. You were a victim, you say, yourself. When did this happen?
Oh, that was Memorial Day weekend, 1984, a massive rainstorm of what hit the Tulsa, Oklahoma area, and flood control plane dams broke. And so a large part of the city went underwater, and I was one of those who lost everything.
You live with this at all times in Oklahoma, which is part of Tornado Alley, and tornadoes, unlike hurricanes, don't leave time to prepare. But nonetheless, the stories this week indicate that there are ordinances or not ordinances in most places, or building code requirements for shelters and houses, schools, businesses, and only about 10% of the homes in Moore had them. Will that change?
There's really no way of knowing at this point. All the focus is right now on helping the victims and restoring things, getting people's lives back together, and then I'm sure there's going to be a lot of debates over policy.
For those, and I know some people in this area who would like to help in some way, what is the best way to reach out and contribute to the cause right now?
Well, the best way is simply to go to a website that's been set up called OK Strong. And if you just plug that into your browser, it'll take you right through it. The full address is okstrong.ok.gov. And there is a ton of information on it. It's being updated all the time, but there is a tab there for donation information, and you can go from there and make your choice as to what you'd like to do.
That's okstrong.ok.gov.
Correct.
And Matt Skinner has lived in Oklahoma now for over 25 years. You said you were at a tornado in Tulsa in 1984. That's 29 years. A native of New York. But most people who live through these things and they have an attachment to an area, and we can say the same for hurricanes in Louisiana, they don't pick up and leave. They just fight back.
Right. You go and you rebuild. There's a reason that I live here. My New York family has yet to figure it out. But and one of the reasons, quite frankly, and Jim, you and I have talked about this over the years, is just at times like this, when you see the response of the community and differences are put aside and everybody works together. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that's not true in New York, but it is certainly a kind of spirit that is out here that it just made me decide this is where I'd like to stay, even though it can be challenging at times.
A listener, Kerry, points out that Oklahoma City is, as far as the metropolitan area, one of the biggest is in landmass in the United States. That's correct, isn't it?
That is correct, yeah.
And I guess the city is one of the largest as far as land, probably much bigger than New York City.
Oh, yes, it dwarfs New York City in terms of square miles. I know it's in the top five. The Oklahoma City, in terms of land mass, is in the top five. But I don't know where it is on the list anymore. And then the Oklahoma City metro area is quite large.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you get these kinds of warnings, and they come swiftly, that a tornado, a funnel cloud has developed, a tornado is on its way, what do people generally do?
Well, you immediately head for shelter. When you look at the kind of damage that's been done, and it's absolutely horrific, the fatality list, obviously, one is too many. But when you look at the damage that's been done and how powerful this thing is, this is the first time I have ever heard from people saying that they didn't think their storm shelter door, which are massively reinforced, was going to hold. I mean, they were actually twisting and being pulled out. And there was one unconfirmed story of someone who did actually lose a door off their storm shelter. I don't know if that's been confirmed yet.
We're talking over 200-mile-an-hour winds, aren't we?
Yeah, just absolutely unbelievable force. And then, of course, the speed with which this took place was remarkable. I watched it form. We had TVs on here, and I was tracking the storm, and one of the TV stations had a chopper right near it. As it started to form, it became a monster wedge tornado so quickly. I've never seen anything quite like it. But what you do is you get into shelter, obviously. The one thing that certainly helped is that people were on edge because the National Weather Service, and they have one of their biggest and best operations right in Norman, Oklahoma, which is next door to Moore, at the University of Oklahoma. And Richard Smith, who's the chief meteorologist there, I think, and his staff deserve a ton of credit, because I'm also part of the Office of Emergency Management as a liaison. And so all the liaisons were briefed, and all the OEM people were briefed by Richard that morning, saying this is going to be bad. This is all the conditions are lining up, and when these things fire off, when these storms fire off, they can go tornadic quickly. And he had the time he was worried about was correct. I mean, and the warnings that they were giving out, they deserve I think their work deserves a lot of credit, because I think people are alive today because they were watching out, on edge and waiting to see if something would form.
David in Lafayette, you're on the air with Matt Skinner. Good morning, David.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. First off, I want to say that I was in the military, and I was stationed at Fort Sill in Oklahoma, and I absolutely loved my time out there. I think it's a wonderful state, and they've got beautiful people there. Jim, I may be asking a question that you haven't gotten to just yet, but to the gentleman, to your guest, two of your senators had major opponents for the disaster aid for the Sandy hurricane victims. What's their stance as of right now as far as disaster aid for the tornado victims?
All right. Did you hear it, Matt?
I did, and I do not know what Senator Inhofe's position is. I know Senator Coburn has been quoted as saying, so I'm obviously giving this third hand, but he has been quoted as saying that any disaster relief for Moore must be paid for elsewhere in the federal budget.
Must be paid for in the federal budget. So,
in other words, there has to be an equal saving somewhere else.
Okay, cuts then, I guess. Quite often when we think of tragedies hypothetically, we think of them much differently than we do when they happen on our front porch. So I don't think the senators from Oklahoma would be any different than senators in other places when it comes to some hometown legislation as far as attempting to get as much as they can for these people who obviously have been touched in a profound way. $2 billion in damage, that is significant.
The great irony behind that figure is at least some of that number is because after the May 3rd, 1999 tornado, there was a huge rebuild effort, plus and more grew as well. It's very difficult now to know when you're leaving Oklahoma City and going into Moore. It's all one long developed stretch, and there was a great deal of new construction, new businesses, and so on and so forth in the area that got hit.
Well, thank you, Matt Skinner. Good to visit with you. Sorry it's under these conditions, but nice to talk with you.
Always nice to talk to you, Jim.
Take care, and we'll return with CB for Gonston after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. CB for Gonston, Capital Watcher, former chief counsel for the Appropriations Committee at the Louisiana Capitol a few years ago, and now a avid blogger. He was one of the first to start commenting via the Internet regarding happenings at the state capitol and beyond in Louisiana. And we're talking well over a decade now that forgotston.com has been one of the most prominent web addresses for people who are consumed with Louisiana people and politics. 297-5633. Good morning, CB.
Morning, Jim. I better quit while I'm ahead with that introduction. I don't want to change anybody's mind.
Well, speaking of quitting while ahead, yesterday, a guy I'm sure you know, Quinn Hillier, he was on this show, and then he gets off, he hangs up the phone, says, Jim, I got to go, I got an announcement to make, and I get this note a few hours later saying that he's running for Congress in the state of Alabama.
Wow.
He buried the lead on the show, says Hillier announced that I'm reading a national story Thursday that he'll run in the special election to fill the seat of Representative Joe Bonner, who's leaving Congress to become a vice chancellor at the University of Alabama. Quinn Hillier, of course, a New Orleans native and writes for the American Spectator. I always like it when journalists get into the political arena, quite often unsuccessfully, I might add, but give him credit. He's getting in the arena.
Well, I'm proud of him and putting his money where his mouth is and himself. I mean, it should be an interesting experience. I didn't realize he was living in Alabama, and is he actually living in Alabama
now? See, now you're already starting trouble for the man. I don't know. I know he's been.
Well, you don't have to live in the state necessarily to run for Congress.
No, but it could become an issue that he spends a lot of time in Washington, obviously, because he's writing for the American Spectator. But he used to write for the Mobile Press Register, so I guess that's the Alabama connection. But before we get too far into the conversation here, do you have any political announcements to make, CB, regarding your run for office at some point?
Well, I'm contemplating not holding a press conference in the near future to announce what I'm not going to do.
Well, it is amazing when people like, who was it, Jay Darden said he's not running for the U.S. Senate, and there's a big bold, I can understand it if he says I am running, that's worthy of a headline, but when somebody says they're not going to do something, is it really news?
Well, I don't think so, but in order to defend myself so people don't think I'm running for something, I feel obligated periodically to announce that I'm not running for something. I don't want to be accused of being a politician.
Jason on Jones Creek leads off for CB for Gonston. Jason, you're on the air with CB.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Enjoy your website, CB.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you for your information. You always put some great, entertaining, and concise information on there. I had a question. What do you think? What's the latest? With the latest information this morning, I read about a grand jury to hear the evidence in the CNSI probe. What's your opinion on that? I'll hang up and listen.
Well, it's going to sound rather cynical because I've heard some people saying, well, are they going to indict Bobby Jindal and things like that? State grand juries are a little different than federal grand juries. They are used by district attorneys to handle political hot potatoes, except in the case of capital crimes, which they are required to convene a grand jury to indict somebody for capital crime. Usually it's the case where the DA doesn't want to be the one to either bring the charges or to let somebody off, because the DA has the power to decide whether to prosecute anyone, except, as I've said, in the case of capital crimes. And so I suspect this is more of a scenario just to say that the matter has been looked into and they find no fault by anybody at the state level. So that's, you know, it may sound cynical, but I've been there, seen that, done that, and expect this is pretty much the same thing. As the saying goes, and it's true,
a district attorney can indict a ham sandwich in a state grand jury because it's a one-sided presentation. By the same token, if they don't want somebody indicted, it's very easy for the district attorney or assistant district attorney to make that clear either. And the same goes for the attorney general. They're mm-hmm. the same type grand juries.
The CNSI folks have hired ace PR man Sonny Cranch to represent them, and he has emailed in the last few minutes a missive saying the following is on the record, Jim. CNSI is committed to finding out why our contract was canceled and determine what facts, if any, would support the state's allegations of wrongdoing. To date, the state has provided no evidence to support its abrupt cancellation of the approved contract that was in force for over 1 year. That is why the company has not only sued the state for wrongful termination of that contract, but also had to seek the court's concurrence that we are entitled to public records in the state's possession regarding the cancellation, a request for public records that was initiated by our attorneys on April 5th, in which the request of the state is improperly stonewalled every step of the way. We believe that the state has not provided the requested records because they know an examination will reveal no legitimate cause for cancellation. That from Mr. Sonny Cranch, a fine gentleman who's hard at work for CNSI. Now, first of all, let's talk about the request for public records. Sonny Cranch isn't alone. Why do people get so much grief when they try to get records that belong to them?
Jim, the only thing I can say, and I'm going to say this, they must have something to hide when they won't give you the public records. It's one thing when you ask for some records that don't exist, and the public needs to understand that you can't ask any government agency to put together information for you or to respond to a question if they don't want to. But what the public records is for, and what I suspect that CNSI is requesting, are documents that they know to exist. And I don't understand the way that most of us have to deal with this, and Tom Aswell has sued several times, another blogger, to get information that were clearly public records. So it just seems to me that when an agency does that, it should be assumed that they have something to hide. I just think we ought to say that if they don't produce a public record, they're guilty until proven innocent.
Well, and Sonny says they requested on April 5th. This is May the 24th, so that's 54 days. That's 7.5 weeks, which is a long time when you're trying to make a case that you're innocent of the allegations that are out there in the public realm. The former secretary, Bruce Greenstein, he's kind of been hung out there to dry. Now, some might say he should have been, but nonetheless, he seems to be the guy who's being portrayed as the scapegoat in this.
Well, he may be a scapegoat, but he's also has lied under oath in public before the legislature by saying he had no communication with CSNI or CNSI. And so I think he's made his own mess. Whether he had any actual influence over the awarding of the contract is something for others to decide, but I know that he has lied, and it's a matter of public record. But let's go back to the days that have transpired since CNSI has made this request. I don't understand why members of the public or businesses wait so long to file a lawsuit. The agency has 3 days, 3 working days, in which to respond that they won't give you the records and cite the law, the specific law under which they are exempt. That doesn't mean they can wait 3 days. That means they have a maximum of 3 days. Theoretically and legally, you can walk into any state agency to the receptionist desk and ask to see a public record that you know exists right then. And they don't have any, they have to go get it and bring it to you and show it to you. And if you want a photocopy of it, you can pay them to make it, or you can make your own copies with the cameras we have on our phones. You can do it right now. I've taken scanners to public offices and just scan the information so I didn't have to
pay for it. Well, and then When the governor floated out his tax plan and he picked up all the sheets after doing so, he didn't know that Representative Ted James was in there taking photos of the document, so it got out pretty quickly. It's a little harder to conceal things today than it used to be. Jim Brown,
and it should be.
Jim Brown, who was on this show a few days ago, the former state Politico, he says that Governor Jindal, curiously, is calling for investigations of the Obama administration on the IRS, and that that governor has said nothing about CNSI. No surprise there. That's just politics, isn't it, CB?
Well, I think it's hypocrisy is what it is, and you can't separate politics and hypocrisy any more than you can separate politics from government. It seems to be just the normal thing, and that's what actually drove me to start writing my blog in 2000, is hearing legislators come back home saying one thing when I knew they did another at the legislature.
Well, do you think this is going to be a big story regarding CNSI, or is it one that will go away quickly?
No, I think it's a big story, and I think it needs to be resolved for everybody's sake. And, you know, as Sonny's pointing out, they want to get to the bottom of it. And to me, you know, you don't file a civil suit like CNSI has, I'll get it right eventually, without knowing that there's discovery, meaning that the state will have the right to ask the company any information that they want. And it could be, you know, if they had something to hide, they would know that. So to me, I think it kind of bodes ill for the state, and it did seem like kind of just a political reaction to getting caught with their hands in the cookie jar for the state to suddenly cancel the contract. I, for one, would like to know the truth, whether it takes a grand jury or a civil lawsuit. I think we're entitled to know. This is a massive contract, and I don't have any faith in the general administration. They haven't proved themselves to be trustworthy.
But here's one of CB's messages of the week. You say, often I call out Bobby Jindal for his serial hypocrisy, CB's words. Now it's time for the House of Representatives to be recognized as a body for the same thing. For the last 6 years, I've written and talked often about legislators who erroneously blame the state constitution for tying their hands when it comes to budget matters. Additionally, for the last 6 years, I heard countless legislators say that Louisiana needs to hold a constitutional convention to free up revenues locked in the state constitution. In a column written in The Advocate, CB notes, we find that legislators are about to tie their own hands. What's happening?
Well, they just voted in the House 99-6 to put over $1 billion more into a trust fund in the state constitution. And whether that's a good thing to do, whether the money needs to be squirreled away in a trust fund, it's just a total hypocrisy for the legislators to whine and complain that they don't have any authority to prevent higher education and health care from being cut when they're making the problem even worse.
You had another story this week saying Louisiana GOP is seeing black helicopters.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, it was funny that the legislative auditor wrote to all the state parties that I understand. I think there's we probably only have two that are active, and that's the Louisiana Democratic Party and Louisiana GOP, asking for some copies of documents, which I think they've already filed in other places, but the law required them to be filed with the legislative auditor, and they haven't been filed with the legislative auditor. State statute is 40 years old. And so the Louisiana Democratic Party says, oh, okay, sorry, here's a copy. The GOP goes ballistic and starts ranting about, you know, it's a conspiracy by somebody to cause some kind of damage to the Louisiana Republican Party, and I'm going, you know, and they're comparing it to the IRS investigation of the Tea Party. The problem is at the federal level, you know, for those conspiracy theorists, you have a Democratic president, and you have a Democratic Senate that, you know, they may have sicked the IRS on these conservatives. But in the state, to talk about the legislative orator, which works for the majority party, which controls Louisiana legislature and a Republican governor, it just doesn't even compute. And then you go back and you look a little further into then they in the course of their frantic helicopter sightings, the Louisiana GOP says, we want all the email correspondence from the Louisiana legislators for a period of about the last month that were made to any correspondence with the legislative auditor, basically blowing the whistle on them. And the and it turns out the Times-Picayune reports, and apparently he didn't think it was any big secret, there was a Republican legislator who contacted the legislative auditor complaining that the parties had not followed the law, which makes the Louisiana GOP going off the edge just seem like a bunch of frightened children.
Right.
And so it was a lot to do about nothing. It grabbed some headlines, which only came back to make the Louisiana GOP look like idiots.
Well, speaking of the Louisiana GOP, the two most prominent members of the GOP in the state outside of the governor, Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden and U.S. Senator David Bruce Vitter, are both out there raising money. John McGinnis reports that Darden recently raked in $118,000 at the home of James Carville and Mary Madeline in a fundraiser. And Senator Vitter has an event, an alligator hunt, $5,000 ahead, that looks like it could be the first foray into the governor's campaign, governor's race in 2015. Do you think those two will be toe-to-toe on the campaign trail for governor of the great state of Louisiana, CB?
Well, that's conventional wisdom. I have a little different take on it. First of all, I think that if David Vitter runs for governor, it doesn't make any difference which other candidates run for governor. He will be the gubernatorial candidate. But I'm starting to think that Vitter is less likely to be a gubernatorial candidate if during the midterm elections next fall the Republicans gain control of the Senate. I really don't see David Vitter leaving the Senate with a Senate majority. And so I think that, and David Vitter has plenty of time to make his decision. The current fundraising effort, the alligator hunt, the money can be used for either the state or federal campaigns. So he's got a lot of flexibility. He's got pretty much universal name recognition, Vitter does. So he doesn't have to make a decision on whether he's going to run for re-election to the Senate or for the governor until after the midterm elections next fall.
We'll talk more with CB for Gonston when we return after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. In a few moments, we'll hear from James Lacy. His book is Moment of Battle, The 20 Clashes That Changed the World. We rejoin CB for Gonston, Capital Watcher Supreme, 297-5633, if you'd like to join the conversation. John in Lafayette. John, you're on the air with CB. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim, CB. I had a question on the constitutional dedications. The Advocate had reported, CB, a couple of years ago, that really a lot of these dedications were statutory rather than constitutional. In other words, the legislature could invade those statutory dedications and get some money for the health care and for higher education if they wish to. And they use the dedications as an excuse to do nothing. Am I right or wrong about that?
CB? Are you there, my friend? All right. Let's see if we can restore contact with CB, and we will do our best to make contact with the man who now lives in Hammond. Is that you, CB? Okay. I think see what's going on, Kevin. I think we've lost all our phones for a moment. 297-5633, and I'd like to get CB to respond to John before we go to James Lacey. Did want to note, and this was something I intended to mention with CB, if you've followed the news the last day or so, up to 20 named storms have been predicted for the hurricane season. So it looks like we're headed for a strong hurricane season, 7 to 11 to become hurricanes, winds of 74 miles per hour or greater, and 3 to 6 major hurricanes, meaning Category 3 or 4 or 5 with winds of 111 miles per hour or greater. So it could be a dynamic hurricane season, and one that we've been here before, and sometimes these predictors are wrong. But usually they're pretty close to the mark when it comes to making predictions, and the hurricane season starts June 1st. Don in Mid-City. Don, good morning. You're on the air. Hi, Don.
Good morning, Jim. Look, I've been following this situation with Napoleonville and Bayou Corn, and this week I understand that the company has basically told the people we're not ready to settle and buy you out. This matter's been going on since August the 7th, and in my opinion, the governor has really been absent in this matter because he spent a whole lot of his time in other states campaigning and giving speeches, and I don't see the urgency that he put into Plaquemines Parish and the coastline during BP that he's done with this with Bayou Corn. Now, I know Texas Brine is a real big company. I've looked at some of the investors are, and they're big contributors to some of the people Jim will represent outside of Louisiana.
All right. CB is back here. So Don in Mid-City asked about Bayou Corn and I guess about the governor's late action regarding a visit and now swinging into action saying that these people will be made whole. I saw a photo on the front page of the Baton Rouge Advocate on Tuesday of the governor hugging a lady. Betty Thibodeau, CB, were you moved by the governor going down to Assumption Parish?
Not at all, and I wasn't even moved by the hug that he gave. It was kind of a half-hearted one, like he didn't want to put his arms around the woman.
Well, come on.
I know it's just being nitpicking, but you ask, I wasn't moved by his actions, and I think that, while his rhetoric is, we're going to force them to do this and force them to do that. It's been months since he promised all that, and nothing has happened.
Well, earlier,
when
we lost contact with you a few moments ago, John in Lafayette asked a question that was a follow-up to the dedicated funds and higher education being the whipping boy when it comes to these cuts. Is there any way to get around this?
To get around the
higher education always being on the chopping block.
Sure. The legislature just has to reorder the priorities in the budget and stop socking away more money in the Constitution. They're just taking another $1.2 billion, I believe it is, out of the hands of the legislature and that they can't do. But right now they could give higher education money. Every time higher education raises tuition, they offset that by reducing the amount of state money that goes into higher education. So it's just very simple. If higher education is a priority, you fund that first, and then if there's money left over, you fund these little local projects that are just merely bringing home the bacon but don't do any good for the state at large.
Well, CB, it's always nice to talk with you. Hope you have a good holiday.
You too, Jim.
Take care. Let's do it again. And we're joined now by James Lacey, an interesting man who is also the author of The First Clash, but his latest work is Moments of Battle, The 20 Clashes That Changed the World. James has written for Time, National Review, Foreign Affairs, and he currently teaches at the Marine Corps War College and at Georgetown University. Good morning, James Lacey.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Well, your book has gained a lot of attention, and when you talk about 20 clashes that changed the world, there have been many battles and wars through the years. Must have been hard to cut it to 20.
The Amazon reviewers, everyone who hasn't doesn't see their favorite battle in there makes a point of telling us we're probably have to go to a publisher and say, can we put out volume two of the next 20 battles that changed the world? We had a criteria, and it was battles we're still feeling the effects of today.
Well, four of the battles, James, relate to World War II.
Correct.
And, of course, some big ones were left out. But you start with the Battle of Britain, 1940. What happened there?
Well, this is Britain standing alone. France is defeated. Russia hasn't come into the war yet. We're still over a year away from coming into the war. The full might of the German Luftwaffe was thrown against Britain, preparatory to making an invasion of Britain. It's hard to believe that World War II could have been won if Britain had fallen, if we had lost that island fortress right off the coast of France that allowed our entry. By winning the Battle of Britain and then Hitler turning east to Russia, the course of World War II and the life we're now living was definitely changed.
So most people are probably unaware of the significance of the Nazis being stopped in 1940, and you're making the case that if they had not, they might have ruled the continent of Europe and maybe ruled the world.
Yeah, they may have, but at the very least, they would have held on to Europe for quite a long time. You know, Nazism probably, like communism, would have died a terrible death of it under its own weight, but 50, 60, 70 years is a long time to suffer. When we're looking at the World War II battles and what changed the world, that's where most of the arguments mm-hmm. take place. I mean, some people could make a case that Pearl Harbor was the most decisive battle. We didn't make it, but you know, once the United States was in, everyone would say, well, the rest of it's a foregone conclusion. It's just a matter of time.
Well, and a listener notes, this is Mark, he notes that if the Nazis had won the Battle of Britain in 1940, that the United States might ultimately have had to use nuclear weapons in Europe as well.
Right. I mean, if Hitler had done better... I'm going to call it a nuclear sweepstakes because that makes light of the awesome power that's delivered by a nuclear weapon. But there's a good chance that Berlin would have been the target rather than Hiroshima. But then you're still left with without England. Where did those planes take off from? Mm-hmm. I mean, how do we get to the continent? We didn't have transcontinental bombers yet of any reliability. B-29 at the end of the war probably could have gotten there, but it would have been a heck of a job.
And the last of the four wars or battles of World War II, Normandy, that one we know about, June 6, 1944, the death knell for Nazi Germany. How important was Normandy?
Well, it was the death knell, and that's a very good way of saying it. I mean, once we were ashore, it was completely decided. But what we had to, Germany was probably going to be beaten anyway. The Russian juggernaut was moving. What the entry into the continent made certain of is that that all of Europe wouldn't fall into Soviet domination at the end. If we hadn't entered the continent, what happens if the Soviet tanks had rolled all the way to the channel? We'd have had a serious Soviet empire to deal with on the other side of at the end of World War II. We still had one, but it would have been an empire that stretched across the entire continent of Europe. So mm-hmm. looking in terms of how it affects the world today, it was crucial that we entered into the land battle in Europe rather than let the Russians roll over the entire continent.
The book is The Moment of Battle from Bantam Books. It's getting a lot of attention nationally. The 20 Clashes That Changed the World with James Lacy and also with Williamson Murray. The one battle that you choose in the Civil War, some might find interesting, Vicksburg, 1863. You say the Confederacy was broken in that battle. How so?
It split the Confederacy. Everything that was all the supplies, logistics from one side of the Mississippi were no longer available. Most importantly, Texas and horses. Horses weren't making their way back into the rest of the South. From Vicksburg on, Union cavalry started to become dominant on the battlefields, even in Northern Virginia, because they couldn't get remounts for the Confederate cavalry. But the West is where the war was fought, won and lost. It was the logistical breadbasket for most of the South. When it opened up the doorway for Sherman's march to the sea, Vicksburg could have held. There was still a chance that there would have been some sort of negotiated peace. The North was getting weary. Gettysburg was vital. Mm-hmm. I think that's what everyone would be looking for. If not Vicksburg, what would you have put in Gettysburg? But even with the South under massive attack from all along its rear, the armies of Northern Virginia held out for another year and a half after Gettysburg, and could have held out indefinitely. Mm-hmm. had Sherman not been able after Vicksburg to march across Georgia and break the South one more time. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, the Revolutionary War is featured in the Battle of Saratoga.
Right.
1777, the first true American victory. How significant was this to the formation of the country as we know it?
Without Saratoga, the chances are we lose. Saratoga brought in the French regular troops, a lot of French money, a lot of French weapons. Without the French fleet and French troops at Yorktown, the British would never have surrendered. They've just got picked up by their fleet and moved someplace else. Saratoga told the world that the Americans could beat a British army in the field, and that there was a chance that they could win with help. And it brought the French in on our side, brought the Spanish in, and suddenly, instead of fighting a civil war, guerrilla war, or revolutionary war just in North America, Britain is facing a world war that's diverting substantial resources away from the North American continent. And in fact, after we got our independence and the British left, the war with France and England continued. France and Spain and England between them continued for another couple of years. England finally beat them both down, but she couldn't afford to beat them down and fight us at the same time. So without Saratoga, we'd have a king. We may be Dominion status, the same as Canada. No one knows how the world would have changed at that point, but it definitely would have been a remarkably different world.
Most Americans would probably not name Saratoga and Vicksburg as the two places on American soil that have produced the most significant battles in the history of our country, but you make a plausible case that those are the ones that are above all others. What are some that you were on the cutting room floor that came close to being in the top 20 in the U.S.?
In the U.S., I've always, and this is, I'm not playing up to a Louisiana radio station here. New Orleans has always been a very decisive and interesting battle for us. I mean, it happened after the war. I credit Battle of New Orleans and Midway. If God is an American citizen, he has taken a fond liking to us. British regulars that attacked New Orleans, they had been fighting Napoleon for 10 years. They came here and found mostly militia and pirates and hastily raised citizen forces and got decisively beaten. By all the rules of warfare, all the laws of warfare, that should never have happened. They should have just gone into New Orleans and pushed that militia aside.
Was Andrew Jackson the true hero of the Battle of New Orleans?
Without Andrew Jackson, I don't think it happens. You needed someone of his stature at the time and his personality to hold such a diverse and uneven, uneasy force together. But even with Andrew Jackson there, Battle of New Orleans is something of a miracle, and it changed the outlook of this country. We were coming out of the War of 1812 feeling down, beaten. Economically, if not ruined, we were in a crisis situation, and New Orleans changed how this country looked at itself, put us on, a road where we said, "Oh, we could do anything. We beat this great British army. This is This puts us on the road to manifest destiny, I think. So if there's one other battle that's decisive, that's on American soil, that's probably it.
That's number 21.
21. Yeah, that's what I tell everybody. If your favorite battle isn't in there, if we'd gone to 25, it definitely would have made the list.
So that's the moment of battle, the 20 clashes that changed the world, and it starts with Marathon, Athens Saves Western Civilization. That one, by the way, was in 490 B.C. James Lacy, thank you for joining us today. Happy Memorial Day to you. I'm sure this will be a good read for people who have loved ones and those who are with us who have fought in battles around the world. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Take care, my friend, and have a good holiday, everybody. We'll be back Monday. Until then, for Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.